Could a local priest be on the path to sainthood? I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, the journey of Father Jerome Ziliak from his childhood on a Gibson County farm to serving the poorest of the poor in India for 50 years. Father Jerry touched the untouchables. Sharing the Father Jerry story are Mary Ellen Ziliak, whose latest book is Touching the Untouchables, The Heart of a Missionary, and Caroline Nellis, who traveled to India to produce a documentary on Father Jerry's mission called Heroes Still Walk. We hear how this farm boy priest transformed an impoverished village, uplifting the poor with better ways to grow crops and feed their families. There's now a church, school, and a clinic in Kharpur, thanks to Father Jerry. 2 Main Street is next, presented by the Berger Rin Group at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, as we celebrate the life and legacy of Father Jerry Ziliak. The priest, who grew up on a Gibson County farm, shipped out to India as a young man and spent 50 years touching the untouchables, teaching the poorest of the poor how to better their lives. He built water wells, schools, a dispensary, brought electricity to the village of Kharpur, and most importantly, shared his farming knowledge to feed the hungry. Father Ziliak died at the age of 92, but his legacy lives on. Here to share the story of Father Jerry are Mary Ellen Ziliak, whose new book is Touching the Untouchables, The Heart of a Missionary, and Caroline Nellis, who went to India to produce a documentary on Father Jerry's work called Heroes Still Walk. So ladies, welcome to 2 Main Street. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Mary Ellen, let's start with you. You sent a petition recently with the Archdiocese of Chicago to consider Father Jerome Ziliak for canonization. So tell me about that.
Well, that was an exciting step. And yes, I did petition the Archdiocese of Chicago, which is where Father Jerry Ziliak died. And to petition someone for sainthood, you have to approach the diocese that they died in, not okay. where they were raised. So I sent the petition to His Eminence, Cardinal Blaise Supich. He oversees the Archdiocese of Chicago. So that was sent about 2 weeks ago. And for sainthood, it's a very regimented process with four steps. So right now we are just praying that that first step happens, which is declaring Father Jerry a servant of God. Okay. So that's what we're hoping for now. So that could be a week, a year, a decade
sure,
or longer.
Sure. Now, Caroline, you traveled to this remote village in India where Father Jerry spent almost all of his priesthood. But you made two trips to India, right?
Right.
What was this first trip about?
The first trip was I hadn't had a vacation in 10 years, and I'd saved some money up, and I decided to do a half-a-year backpacking trip around Southeast Asia. So my Aunt Lucy, my mother was a wine sapple, and two of her sisters married into the Schmidt family, which had a whole bunch of boys, and one of the other people that married into the Schmidt family was Geneva Ziliak, who was Father's sister. And so since she was my aunt's sister-in-law, they said, if you get to anywhere near his place in India, you've got to stop and see Father Jerry. And the first month I went through, I didn't. I went up 2 months in Nepal, and then I was heading back through India, and I was heading for Singapore, and then I was hoping by ferry to hop skip my way through Indonesia down to Australia. So I was not interested in prolonging my trip, you know, in India. But when the train, I looked at the train route, I saw that it was getting close to Kharpur, and I thought, Aunt Lucy's going to ask me. And I can't lie to her, and I can't disappoint her, so I'll just go in. I was writing a series of articles for the Evansville Courier on my trip. And I thought, well, there's a lot of Weinsapples and Ziliaks and Schmidts, and they'll probably enjoy a story about him. So I'll just get off the train, go in for a day or two, get my article and my pictures, and then I'll be on to Australia. And I made my plan, but I wasn't taking into account that I was going to meet one of the more amazing people in my life. And I stayed 3 weeks, and I never made it to Australia.
Now, that was your first trip, right?
That was my first trip.
Now, the second time, you went back and produced this documentary.
Right. I found out he was being retired after basically about 50 years. And what I had witnessed that first trip was so amazing to me. I thought, that needs to be documented, because so much of what he's doing is applicable through a lot of the third world. And I was hoping it would get more interest in the third world. It really didn't move that far. But I think I didn't know until the day he picked me up at the train that he was going to be so astounding. When we were, you know, he picked me up at the train and we're in his Jeep. It's too noisy, the Jeep ride, to talk at all. And so I'm sitting there and I'm just looking, and I thought, I think I see green out there. And I had not seen any green in the mid part of India at all, not the first time I went up nor the coming back, because they were in the midst of a 3-year drought.
Oh, my.
And it was just, people's bones were showing, the animals. It was emaciation. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't green. I mean, it was just a brown, desolate landscape. And I kept blinking my eyes and I kept thinking, boy, that looks like green. And I kept blinking and it kept getting larger, and I thought, that is green. What would be green out here? And as we got closer, it started defining into trees, teak trees and bamboo groves and crops. There's this 100+ acres of green in the midst of total devastation.
And that's Father Jerry's work.
That was Father Jerry's work. And I thought, how did he manage to do that in the middle of a 3-year drought?
We're going to talk a lot about his his farming techniques, what he mm-hmm. brought to India during this program. Now, Mary Ellen, I attended your book launch. Mm-hmm. I also shared my review of Touching the Untouchables. Here's the closing paragraph of my review. Touching the Untouchables is an action-filled adventure as we follow the journey of a 13-year-old boy as he embarks on a lifetime of service, a world away from his family's southern Indiana farm. We meet a cast of characters, feel the blazing heat, and dodge arrows from angry tribesmen. But in the end, Father Jerry brushes off the dust, lies down on his mat, and thanks God for a good day and a good life. There's a lot of adventure in this book, Touching the Untouchables, and it's all from a journal that you discovered. Tell me about that.
Well, the journal is, I'd like to say it's a nice, neat combination of pages, but the journal and notes and scraps of paper and old calendars has all the information that I shared in Touching the Untouchables book. But I came across it after I'd made a promise to Father Jerry that I'd write it all down for him. And my mother-in-law, who was also Mary Ellen Ziliak, was the last remaining person of Father Jerry's generation in the Ziliak family. She was a sister-in-law. So my father-in-law was naturally married to Mary Ellen, and Father Jerry and Leonard were brothers. So she inherited a lot of his personal belongings. So she shared that with me, knowing I was looking to put something like a book together about Father Jerry. So I found the scraps of papers and journals in her attic, and that's what got me started writing the book. It took 3 tries. It took 13 years, so it was a labor of love. But it all started with what I found in her attic amongst toys and what everybody keeps in their attic, junk.
Right. Now, of course, you wrote this book after making a promise to Father
yes.
Jerry on his deathbed. That's an interesting story as well. He kind of grabbed your hand, didn't he?
He did. I was one of 5 Ziliak members who went to Techne, Illinois, outside Chicago. And that's where Father Jerry had retired as a Divine Word priest. And we were up there because we had gotten a call from the nurse saying, he's taken a turn for the worse. You need to come see him now if you want to say goodbye. July of 2012.
Oh,
yes. And so we went up there, the five of us, and the idea was to kind of sort through his belongings and see what he wanted to go where. You know, it was just the end of life decisions. And not being a blood relative, having married into the family, I kind of stood back and let the closer relatives go through belongings. So I hung out with Father Jerry, so I had the best job. And he was debilitated, but very alert and oriented. So we were talking, and he kept up on everything in the family and sports, anything happening in the world. He knew my first book was due out that year. And so he was asking me about it. And then he got really restless. And I said, Father Jerry, what's got you so upset? And he said, my work's not done. And that kind of floored me. And I said, you are 92. You spent 50 years working in the jungles with the poorest of the poor. What do you have left? He goes, I don't have it all written down. And he did. He grabbed my hands and was telling me this very emphatically. And without even thinking much, I said, don't worry, Father Jerry, I'll write it down for you. Well, yeah. So when I said that, there was just an immediate calm came over him, but he clasped my hands and got right in my face. And he said, you promise? I said, yes, I promise. Well, 2 days later, he died.
Right.
So the story continues from there. There was no way I could not keep that promise, but it was a longer journey than I anticipated.
Right. Now, Father Jerry's, of course, service in India, he accomplished a lot there. And, of course, India, you know, you can get sick over there, can't you, Caroline Nellis?
Yes, I found that out in my second, when we went over to actually film. Climate change hit India really, really early because of the devastation and deforestation of such a large population. And so sometimes there would be 3 or 4 years of drought, and then there would be rains that came. And Father was said that he sometimes recorded as much as 5 inches in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
He called them the toad smashers. Anyway, the rainy season was supposed to be over when we went to film, but it wasn't because of climate change. It was dragging on, and we were having storms every day, and there was lots of mosquitoes. When we went to film in the dispensary for the poor, the clinic, the mosquitoes were flying right from the patients onto us, and I ended up with a really horrible mosquito-borne virus. It wasn't when I got back here, I was hospitalized, and the doctor said, it's as if you have simultaneously the symptoms of both meningitis and malaria, but it's neither of those. It doesn't match any sample that we have at all. So it's an unknown virus. And, you know, it affected me for years afterwards.
Really?
Yeah. But it definitely impacted me a lot while I was trying to edit this film that I did, the documentary. I felt like looking back on it, I would have edited it much more tightly than I did, but to just get the editing finished when you're that sick felt like I'd made the touchdown.
But ironically, Father Jerry never got sick, did he?
He didn't. He'd like to just drop the fact that he'd been there all those years and never missed a day of work.
That's amazing.
He just didn't. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he was exposed to some serious stuff like cholera. Mm-hmm. I mean, sick calls. He'd make sick calls and be in these contained spots with serious illnesses.
Mm-hmm. Now, Father Jerry was an environmentalist, wasn't he, who believed in protecting our natural resources. And I guess that's right up your alley, Caroline, because you're really a kind of an advocate for protecting our natural resources. And Father Jerry's a champion, wasn't he?
He's the reason I started.
Oh, really?
Yes. It was seeing what was happening in India. And that was, to me, it was a clue of what was coming for the rest of the world, but it was just happening there so much earlier. And when I saw, he used so much renewable energy. He used wind energy. He used methane digesters from the bull crap.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to say it.
The dung.
Yeah, the dung. Thank you.
Right. The cattle dung.
And he used solar power. He regenerative farming. It was just an amazing. I did not expect anything like that. It was a course. You know, this shows how clever he was. He ended up buying. He did a trade with some farmers that at the edge of his field was this big hill of just stone. And he offered them two of his best acres in trade for that hill of stone. And, of course, they were all laughing like, and he's so smart. After they made the trade, he used that. He put a big water tower at the top. So all he would have to do is use one pump to water, take the water from a well up to that holding tower, and then gravity feed it to every place in the entire 100 acres. So it was just so clever, and no one else would have thought of the importance of gravity feed to keep down mm-hmm. your need for your electricity and your pumping and all that. He mm-hmm. just, he was clicking on every cylinder.
So he got the last laugh there, yeah. didn't he? Now, Mary Ellen, of course, Father Ziliak had a farming background, grew up on a farm.
He did.
What, near Hopstadt, I think?
Yes, in Hopstadt.
Right. And, of course, that knowledge served him well, teaching the Untouchables how to make a living and feed their families. He also brought some seed from southern Indiana to Carpoor.
He did. He did natural hybridization. So, I mean, he did selective breeding and for his seed corn so that it would be ideal in the arid climate and around the monsoon rain. So mm-hmm. he wanted something that was adaptable. So he did research by going to Mexico when he was home on visits and would go to some research areas there. He'd also go to Purdue and tie in their research to try to come up with a seed that was best to grow in India. Mm-hmm. And so that's what he did. And it took him years because he'd plant something and then he'd pick out, oh, this has the right height, this has the right depth of roots. He'd have to space it a certain way. But he did a lot of research and tied in local seed companies also in Indiana to help him come up with the right formulation.
I know pictures in your book and in your documentary of Father Jerry out in the fields.
Mm-hmm.
He's tasting the crops, tasting the soybeans.
Yes.
And making sure everything's going okay.
Yes.
And you didn't see him in priestly garb much, did you?
No. He kind of had a uniform mostly that we see pictures of him in worn jeans and a plaid farm shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And he always wore a pith helmet, uh-huh. which, yeah. Reminded me of Dr. Livingston in the old movies.
My guests are Mary Ellen Ziliak, author of Touching the Untouchables, The Heart of a Missionary, and Caroline Nellis, who traveled to India to interview Father in the village of Carpoor. Her documentary is Heroes Still Walk. And did Father Jerry get to see the film?
Yes, he did.
He did. What was yeah. his impression?
I think he was very delighted with it. He actually came down here. The Evansville Museum allowed us to have an opening reception there. And so Father Jerry got to speak to a lot of people, the people that had supported the documentary, that had given money. And it was, we had a really nice day that day. So I think he was pleased to see that his work could go on after him. And the title for it, actually, the day he was driving me back on that first visit to back to the train station when I was there in 87. As we were leaving, I turned my head and I looked back on it, and I just thought, heroes still walk this earth. Because there are larger-than-life people that you meet that are dedicated, are willing to give up their lives to make other people have a better reality. And I think, to me, he was one of the heroes I met in my life. So When I went to make that documentary a dozen years later, when I found out he was being retired, I thought, oh my God, all that information cannot be wasted, you know. So I went back there, and when I was thinking of the title, I thought, I think it came to me the day I was leaving this place the first time, Heroes Still Walk.
Mm-hmm. Well, coming up, more adventures from the village of Kharpur, battling those monsoons, wild animals, and prejudice. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. We are celebrating the life and legacy of Father Jerome Ziliak, Father Jerry, who spent 50 years in a remote village in India, preaching, teaching, and educating the poorest of the poor, the untouchables. My guests are Mary Ellen Ziliak, a niece by marriage to Father Jerry, and author of Touching the Untouchables, The Heart of a Missionary. Caroline Nellis is here. She produced a documentary on Father Jerry's mission in Kharpur called Heroes Still Walk. Now, Mary Ellen, you were at the father's bedside just days before he died, making that promise to him to tell his story. And you write, how can you say no to a dying priest? And you say kind of Father Jerry kind of guided you through this book writing process?
Well, he died 2 days later, so he did not live to guide me through.
But I think you had visions, and then he talked to you?
He wakes me up early in the morning between 3:30 and 5:30 and puts these crazy ideas in my mind. At the time, I think they're crazy. But I have learned to jot down whatever's placed in my mind and on my heart, and it usually leads to something I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. So I guess you could call that divine intercession. Mm-hmm. But I still feel his influence. And throughout my writing, I have my office set up that I surround myself with his paraphernalia.
Okay.
So I have his notes. I have his journals. I have his scraps of paper. I have his glasses that he wore, and I don't clean them. They're still smudged because he's just a true Ziliak. That's minor, you know, you don't worry about dirty glasses. But if I got to a point that I felt a bit blocked, I'd put his glasses on, and it would distort what I was looking at, but it kind of quieted me and centered me to hear what I was supposed to write next. I feel his influence still today.
That's pretty cool. Now let's learn more about Kharpur. Where is it? How do you get there? Caroline, you got there. How did you get to Kharpur?
Both times by train. And then picked up, I'm trying to think of the name, Madhya Pradesh State. I cannot remember the name of the large town.
Now when you went to the second time, did you fly there?
Both times I went there, I flew in. First time it was Bombay, and the second time I went back, it had been renamed Mumbai.
Yeah.
And then took a train. So train travel was the most, that's what you did mostly for long travel in India.
So then they picked you up at the train station, mm-hmm. Then you had to take
Jeep.
How were the roads to Kharpur then?
Really not so much roads, it's just dirt paths.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Now, what was your first impressions of seeing Kharpur the first time you went there?
It was, like I said, it was very amazing because...
The greenery,
yeah. the crops he was able to produce. It was lovely in, he had large... areas where he was growing a grove of bamboo. So people could use that if they needed something to be cut for housing, you know, building their huts with. So he was trying to make it so they wouldn't have to walk long ways, mm-hmm. because most of the woods of any sort had been deforested.
Right.
The women might have to walk, you know, 3 or 4 hours in order to get to a place that had a few sticks that they could bring home. They would have bundles on their head, and they would be carrying them back enough to heat their huts and also to heat their food. So he tried to make it so that there would be something that they could use right there on the premises. Not everybody... Most of the methane that came out of the digester went to the school for the school's gas system. And then gradually they were building it up and getting, by the second time I was there, some of the individual houses had their own digesters. So it grew the use. The teak trees he planted basically as Social Security, a pension plan for the people in the village. By the time those trees grew up and they got old, that they would have a source of income, because teak sells, you know, it's a tremendously expensive wood.
Well, this is quite a contrast to when Father Jerry first arrived in Carpoor, wasn't it? Because mm-hmm. there was nothing there, really.
Right, right, there was. Well, he started out the first 10 years he was in Jabwa, which was very much a jungle in a mountainous area. So it was even rougher. He called it the roughest of the outback. So Carpoor was a little more civilized.
You no could call arrows.
It. Yeah, not you didn't have arrows flying like you did in the jungle of Jabwa. But those first 10 years, it was a very primitive area of jungle.
And you also write in your book that Father Jerry did not want to go to India.
Well, no. When he graduated from seminary and was ordained a priest in 1947, that mission that he was with was Society of Divine Word. And they trained missionaries, and they were an international seminary. So they went to 5 countries at that time. And he said, "Oh, I'll go anywhere." He said, "But I really don't want to go to India."
He wrote it in capital letters.
And he did.
He said, "Not India."
Not India.
Capital letters.
But he took a vow of obedience, so he went to India. So he learned that lesson the hard way.
Of course, the caste system is, I guess, still kind of lingering on in India. It was officially abolished in 1948, I believe. Prejudice still remains in many parts of the country. Some 3,000 castes, I read. Many more subcastes based on occupations. The untouchables were on the lowest rung of the social ladder. So what did that mean, that lowest rung?
Well, that lowest rung, the way Father Jerry explained it at the time when he got there, was he kind of mentioned 5 castes. And the first 4 were acknowledged by the community, but the outcast were called that initially because they didn't even rate a rank.
Oh, really?
So that's why they were called the outcasts, the untouchables, the Dalits. And so they did not have any kind of privileges, really. Even they could not drink out of the same well as someone of a higher caste. Mm-hmm. They couldn't eat at the same table. A dog under the table could get a scrap. An outcast, an untouchable, could not sit at the same table with a higher caste. Mm-hmm. And even though it was abolished shortly after he got there, it still had a great, great influence on the culture, and there's still some seen today, is my understanding.
Caroline, I know in your documentary, you talk about the relationship between the untouchables and another lower caste, the tribals. And there was a difference between those two ones, wasn't there?
The tribals are the natives of that country. And both of those parts of society. I work with a group that takes care of homeless kids in southern India. I'm a board member for them. And they're still the same people. The outcast and the tribals are the same ones that are still being, you know. It just goes on. Prejudice does not go away easily.
Well, I think even in your documentary you say that the tribals and the untouchables didn't want to drink out of the same
yeah,
well,
right.
Did they?
No.
They thought the other one was the bottom.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, life in Carpoor, subsistence living, when Father Jerry arrived, he wanted to change that, introducing these farming methods he learned back in Hobstadt, and the sustainable farming, what is that? Development, isn't it called sustainable development?
Well, he kind of coined the phrase before, I think, I don't know if he really called it sustainable farming. He called it a respect for earth.
Okay.
His whole thing was, if we live, remind ourselves to respect each other, the earth, the plants, the trees, the animals, everything around us, then we wouldn't have many problems. Mm-hmm. So that's the way he approached his farming, that he respected the earth. It was to be honored because it was a gift from God. Mm-hmm. So he kind of took that approach. He didn't have a a true phrase, but it was sustainable farming in that he didn't want to deplete it. He didn't want to abuse it. He wanted to honor it by using it for what God intended.
Now, Caroline, that's your whole bit in it, interfaith, creation care. That's the group you're with.
Right.
So what's your mission with that group?
Well, it is to promote good stewardship of the earth, which is exactly what Father Jerry
and
was
saying. And all faiths can do that, right?
Yeah, it's an interfaith. Mm-hmm. And I started that, let's see, I think it was in 2015. So we're at 10 years of that. And I've worked with a lot of climate and environmental groups through the years. I've had to cut back in the last couple of years because my family's aging. I need to take help care with, I think family comes before all else. But I will always think that respect for the earth is absolutely crucial for every species that exists, including humans.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to Father Jerry's growing up in southern Indiana. So how did this farm boy end up in the priesthood, Mary Ellen?
Well, Father Jerry shared that at the age of 9, he knew God wanted him to become a priest, which is early. And you think, well, kids change their mind. I wanted to be a ballerina at 9. Well, that didn't happen. But he knew that was his vocation in life. And so he followed the guidance of his pastor at St. James Church, where he went to school and attended church. And at one point he said, you know, Jerry, we need missionaries. Have you given thought to going to Techne? Well, Father Jerry had never heard of Techne, but it came from his mentor. So he ended up going to Techne at the age of 13 to become a priest. So he attended all of high school, college, all up there, and he never came back to live at home again. Mm-hmm. After that age of 13, he just knew in his heart, this is what he was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the documentary, Heroes Still Walk, we actually hear the voice of Father Jerry. Mm-hmm. Has kind of a German accent, doesn't he?
I will tell you, a lot of the, even my aunts, I've noticed, we're all of German descent. And I think a lot of Gibson County and Posey County, they're still the hint of our ancestors. Uh-huh. In our voice. Yes.
Okay.
Now, if I can throw something in, though, I picked up British accent. Now, there's a little British in there. That's what I heard.
Oh, so you pick up British.
Yes. Oh, okay. And some of that, I think, is that first 10 years, he never came home. He was in India speaking Hindi.
Okay.
And India was a colony of Britain for centuries. And I picked up even more of the British accent combined with the German. Anyway, it was hard to understand.
I got the German.
British, Hindi, German.
Yes.
Okay, there we go.
He was a challenge.
Now, in the documentary, we meet some great characters beside Father Jerry. Mm-hmm. Sister Justin.
Wonderful lady, yes.
Tell me about her.
You know, she ran the clinic, which was very important. Everybody needed free medical care, and they're just, you know, that just didn't happen. So she made it happen. And she ran a women's group. Women are really a low echelon of that society also. And those women did not have the money to buy things for themselves. Like, it was so handy if you could have a metal container to hold your water so that you could keep it for days, you know, in a closed metal container. But buying one of those was way too expensive. But her group, they got together once a week, the women in the village that wanted to join, and they would each bring, and I don't remember how many rupees anymore. I don't know if it was 5 rupees. I can't remember. Very minimal amount. And so the women would collectively save that, and when they got enough to afford one of those metal containers, there would be a drawing. And whoever got the drawing, they got purchased one of those metal. And then they would start the whole process over again until every woman owned one. And then they also did that, I think, with owning, I think, goats, so that they would have something that they could milk that would give their family some food and milk and cheese, but then also that they could breed and then be able to maybe sell an animal. Mm-hmm. So Sister Justin was like Father Jerry in that she had that deep commitment of sacrificing for others, but to try to open their world up. And she did a lot for the women and the poor.
We talked about weather playing a major role in the lives of the poor in India because of the extremes in the weather there, the blazing heat, the monsoons, and those long dry spells. Also, animals eating and destroying crops, even wild animals, the story of the panther terrorizing the village, right?
They did deal with wild animals through that time that Father Jerry was there, and they deal with jackals, black panthers, wild pigs, especially in Jabwa, and what was the other thing? Oh, king cobras.
Oh, really?
Deadly king cobras. So there were a lot of animals to deal with, and I know Father Jerry shared the story of a panther grabbing the neighbor's dog off the front porch. But a serious story early on when Father Jerry first arrived into Jabwa was that a panther had killed five village children, and the villagers had not had success bagging the panther. So Father Jerry had one of the few guns, and they approached him asking for his help. And he shared the story that he went out to hunt the panther, and they did kill the panther, and it kind of brought acceptance for him in that village. Yeah, so when I first agreed to write everything down for him, I told my husband on the way home, I said, yeah, I think I agreed to write Father Jerry's panther story. And he laughed. He goes, oh, no, honey, you agreed to write the whole thing.
And also there's a story in Father Jerry's journal about bandits and being attacked by tribesmen armed with bows and arrows. That's kind of a frightening account.
Yes, and that actually happened later in 1990. He had notes of taking a trip to Indore, which was one of the larger, actually may have been the largest city in Madhya Pradesh, the state. And he had business there. So driving there, he drove through Jabwa, where he spent the first 10 years. And it's a very mountainous area. And at the time, the Dacoits is what they were called, which was some of the Aboriginal tribal people that were Bhil, B-H-I-L was the tribe. And they made their living, putting food on the table by hunting, fishing, and looting the travelers. And because things were being depleted, there were less animals and less fish, so the robberies went up. And so when Father Jerry was going through in 1990, there was a lot of attacks of robbers to the travelers going up the mountainside. So the police really did not patrol the whole area. It was too dangerous. There were too many killed. And so they stopped the travelers until they could do a caravan of about 15.
Okay.
So at that time,
a wagon train.
Yeah, it was. It was a wagon train. And Father Jerry was the first waiting for 15 to accumulate. And then those 15 vehicles together went up the mountainside to get through to the other side towards Indore. And so he talks about there were bows and arrows that could attack them, and they were hard for the police to locate because a bow and arrow is very quiet. And so you could not tell what direction it was coming from. So it was a dangerous endeavor, but he just wrote about it like he did how many bushels of wheat he got that week.
So many adventures. My guests are Mary Ellen Ziliak and Caroline Nellis, sharing the story of a southern Indiana farm boy who served 50 years as a priest in India, Father Jerry Ziliak. Coming up, more adventures to share and an update on any progress being made among the poorest of the poor, including that cash crop of teak trees. I'm David James. This is 2 Main Street. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. If you are just joining us, my guests are Carolyn Nellis and Mary Ellen Ziliak. We are sharing the life and legacy of Father Jerry Ziliak, who grew up on a Gibson County farm, became a priest, and served 50 years bettering the lives of the poorest of the poor in India. Mary Ellen Ziliak is fulfilling a deathbed promise to her uncle, telling his story in this new book, Touching the Untouchables, The Heart of a Missionary. Caroline Nellis produced a documentary on Father Jerry's life in Kharpur called Heroes Still Walk. Mary Ellen, in your book, there's a photo of Father Jerry with Mother Teresa, who became Saint Teresa. Anything in the journal about that meeting?
Yes, one of the early notes I came across when I was foraging through the attic remnants was a note that Father Jerry had made in his little pocket notebook that he kept, his how many bushels of wheat he got per acre. And there was a one-line entry saying, Mother Teresa stopping by Thursday to talk about her new place for the girls. And that was the first mention I saw. That was in 1984. So I don't know when they first met, but I know they had some kind of communication at that point in 1984. And then we have a picture that many of us in the Ziliak family have copies of Father Jerry and Mother Teresa clutching hands. And talk, they're bent into each other, leaning forward, talking, and that was taken in 1993. So I know that span of time. She was on the East Coast, he was in North Central India. They kind of compared notes, is my understanding, and worked together trying to do their part in helping the poor.
And he's not in his priestly garb, is he?
Never. No, she's in habit, the blue and white, but no, he's always in his, he did take his hat off for that one picture.
Okay. Now, Caroline, in your documentary, you show the many projects that Father Jerry helped get off the ground. We talked about the harvesting dung as a power source. Also a successful dairy, cow and water buffalo milk.
Yes. because he could keep them cool. He built big pools for them to stand in, so they could stay in that water and stay cool even during the hot season.
So they could produce more milk, right?
Exactly. When nobody else's cattle and bullocks were producing anything, his were producing fine. So that was a good source of income for them. Mm-hmm. And it did get warm. The first time I visited was actually in hot season. And in the under the breezeway, in the coolest place on the whole thing, the thermometer was registering usually 112 degrees. So I'm sure out in the fields it had to be at least 120. It was definitely hot. And the first time I got there, they had just gotten electricity. I mean, it had just hit. So each room had one light bulb, and it had an overhead fan, which went really, really slow. So at night, the coolest part of the day was during the night, and it would still be in the 90s. So everybody took our cots outside, and we slept outdoors in order because the fans moved too slowly to. But it was so beautiful at night because there was no. There was no light pollution. Mm-hmm. There was certainly, no humidity. So the stars were magnificent. It was just a truly lovely part of the experience, I thought.
Well, tell me about the documentary crew. How many people went with you to produce this documentary?
A videographer, our director of photography, and a sound man, and myself. So it was the three of us.
How long were you there to do this film?
3.5 weeks.
3.5 weeks, wow.
Yeah. So I was really lucky. They're both very high-quality people, did a lot of work for National Geographic. And really, of the money we raised, the most money we spent for anything was paying them. Mm-hmm. And I think they did a marvelous job, so we were lucky in that.
Now, Father Jerry, of course, had his ministerial duties over there. Mm-hmm. He was still a priest, had to do that job. Were the Aboriginals religious at all?
Well, the majority in the areas he stayed all those years was highly populated with Hindu religion. Mm-hmm. And I think conservatively, he at one point said, well, 80% of the country is Hindu. I think it might have been higher than that. But so it was very unique and new to introduce mm-hmm. Christianity. Father's approach was very practical. He said, I'm here to bring Christ to everyone. Mm-hmm. But he said, I can't talk to someone about God if their stomach is growling. So his thing was take care of basic needs, and by doing that, you share about God. Mm-hmm. So that was his approach.
Was, of course, when he got there, there was no chapel, obviously.
There was a rough setup, but I don't know that they called it a chapel. Mm-hmm. There was a Father Jerry Hofstey was there several years ahead of Father Jerry.
Oh, there was, okay.
And so he wasn't the first pastor of that mm-hmm. area. So they had an area where they said Mass because, you know, they'd say Mass at least once a day. Mm-hmm. And St. Mary's was the name of the church. But I don't know the first date of St. Mary's offhand. Mm-hmm. I know it was celebrated along the way in the 80s, I think. So it might have been the 30s. I don't know. I'm
now,
sorry, I don't
Carolyn,
have that
when
date.
You were there, was there a chapel when you were there?
It was a nice-sized church when
oh,
I was there.
Oh, it was a church?
Yeah,
okay.
They had built a church, and it was, they had a pretty good, most of the people in the village attended on
really?
Sunday Masses.
Okay.
So it had a, I don't know whether that continued after he was gone or not. Uh-huh. I've been curious.
Uh-huh. I know the population when Father Jerry got to Carpur was 312. And by the time he left, he said there was a little over 1,000 in Carpur, in that
okay.
village.
Okay.
And the average farm size he shared was 15 acres. Mm-hmm. That was a good-sized farm.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm sure when he first arrived, the infant mortality rate was pretty high.
It was very high, yes.
And so
yes.
with this dispensary and then the medical care, I'm sure that mm-hmm. improved dramatically. What's the latest news from Carpur? Have you keep in contact with the
well,
people there?
Well, I have three contacts currently. Two are Divine Word, Society of Divine Word priests, missionaries like Father Jerry was. And one is Sundar. He is an adult now, retired school teacher, who grew up as one of the children in the village of Carpur. So they have been sending me pictures and updates. It's changed quite a bit, but there's still an influence of what Father Jerry had started. The teak trees, I know at one point that Father Jerry started back in the 60-80, I think is when he planted the first teak tree, and that was up to 30,000 at one point. So that still has a presence. So I just recently got something from Sundar, the village child that grew up to be a teacher, saying, I need to come over and see the changes. It's changed, mm-hmm. but he said there's still a strong presence of what Father Jerry started. There is not another missionary that was assigned to actually replace him in that role.
So he is still revered in that community.
He is, yes, and it's... I think part of Sundar's encouragement for me to come over and visit is to appreciate Father Jerry's influence that is still there. Mm-hmm. And I know he shared a picture that is still there of Father Jerry mm-hmm. In the chapel area. So that the church is still there, the school is still there is my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Now, as we wait to hear about this new possible journey to sainthood for Father Jerome Ziliak, your final thoughts on his life and legacy. Caroline, let's start with you.
He was such a down-to-earth person, and yet very clever. He really thought, you know, if he saw a problem, he was going to find a solution to it. And he would do research. You know, during the hot part of the day, they'd do basically like a siesta time. So from noon to 2 or 2:30, everybody goes to their rooms pretty much, you know, and stays away from the heat. And I had the room next to him, and I would hear him during there. The typewriter was going. He was always, he said some of the most valuable classes he took as when he was up at Techni was he learned stenography and typing. And he said, both really handy skills. I can take notes really fast. So he was always, you know, contacting, sending letters out, getting information about possible ways to handle any problem. If he had lived in the day of the internet, that man would have been so happy. It was all slow. You know, he had to send letters all over the place. How would we build this? Send me a diagram. How would we do this? And he had great tenacity of character.
Mary Ellen, your thoughts of Father Jerry?
Well, I feel like he has left us such a rich legacy. And I feel like I'm a conduit that it's the right time to share some of what he lived and taught and shared with his villagers in Kharpur. But I think the time is right to share his message of all living things are connected. Mm-hmm. Because I think our society is so divided right now. That's a challenge we have. That I think Father Jerry's message of all living things are connected is valuable right now. So I think the timing is correct that there's a reason it took 13 years to share this story. We need to be reminded of the most basic thing, that what we do here can affect people across the globe. So we have to be conscious of that and reach out to make those connections. So I feel like some of what's evolving from Father Jerry's days and story is now coming to fruition for that reason.
Again, my thanks to Mary Ellen Ziliak and Caroline Nellis for sharing the journey of Father Jerry Ziliak, who preached love thy neighbor. And as you said, like throwing a pebble in a pond, the ripple effect can go all the way from a farm field in southern Indiana to the jungles of India. Thanks again for being my guest on 2 Main Street.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street. Previous shows are on demand at WNIN.org.